Carl Nichols. Here's part of it.
Listen now, I've a story to tell about some women who lived through hell. They fought in a war in a special way, 12, sometimes 16 hours a day. This is a story of pain and strife and of men's agony and fight for life. She will tell you stories of blood and pain that in her mind will always remain. How many hands in the night did she hold while a young voice cried out, I'm so cold. How many faces does she still see like the memories we have, both you and me? Let us not forget the stories they tell, for they were our sisters who lived through hell. Thank you.
This program was made possible in part by a major grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities, Exploring the Human Endeavor. This is With Good Reason. We'll be right back. Welcome back to With Good Reason from Virginia Humanities. Thousands of women did their part in Vietnam, but thousands more back home were also deeply affected by the war. The wives and girlfriends of the men who fought lived with daily excruciating uncertainty. And then once the men returned, or didn't, these women faced a whole new tragedy. One of them, Emma Violin Sanchez, shares her story of Vietnam, beginning with what was then the all-women Radford College.
It was February 1962. If somebody would have a date, the dorm mother or the person that was in charge downstairs would say, like Sandy Watkins, you have a caller in the parlor. And so my friend, Sandy Watkins, said, oh, Emma, I'm not ready. Go downstairs and meet with this guy. It's a blind date, so I don't know. You tell me what he looks like. And I said, okay, I'm going to go. And then I went, and then I found out. I met this guy. His name was Al Giddings, and he was so cute and so nice. And so I was talking to him, and we were just chatting. Then I excused myself. I went running upstairs and said, Sandy, oh, he is so cute. He is so nice. You are so lucky. So after the date, Sandy comes up and I said, how was he? Tell me. And then she says, oh, he was really nice. His name is Al, but he talked to me a lot about you. That's how our courtship started, Emma and Al. We got married on July 22nd, 1967. After the wedding, we went to Yuma, Arizona, Yuma Proving Grounds. It was, for me, it was an ideal, just living with my husband, furnishing our first place where we were going to live, and then enjoying each other and the friends. But then this was during the Vietnam War, and so the biggest fear during that time was who was going to be called. It was during lunch, I remember, he looked very serious, and so I realized, he said, I have to go to Vietnam in December. Maybe you could get your master's. So after he left, I remember it was snowing, and with a good friend, we drove back to Radford. Radford was like my home. Al and I would write to each other every single day. He was a very positive man, so he would not share any bad news with me. The only thing he would say to me that he would not wish to his worst enemy that would go to Vietnam. Al and I planned to get together on August 27th in Hawaii. And then on August 22nd, you know, I was packing so that I could go to Hawaii. And somebody came to my room and said, there's someone that wants to visit you. And I said, who? And they said, well, it's somebody with uniform, maybe your husband. And I said, no, it can't be my husband. My husband is in Vietnam. And then he told me, I regret to inform you that on August 22nd, Albert Hugh Giddings died with a gunshot wound, unknown causes. That's what he said. And he was just standing there. And I was looking at him, and I was looking at my dorm mother, and I said, oh no. It was just devastating. I remember my aunt Mecha came the next day to visit me at Radford. She said, come on, Emma. And I said, I have to go and get a black dress. I have to go and get a black dress. And she said, why? It's the summer. There's no black dresses. And I said, no, I have to get a black dress. My husband died. I have to get a black dress. And so I went and I got a black dress and I wore a black dress. And people were saying, why are you wearing black? And I said, my husband died. And so I went to my dorm, and it was just so hard for me to see my suitcase with the presents, with all the things that I was taking to go to Hawaii. And just, I don't know, it was just, it required a lot of strength. When somebody dies like that, you get informed. Yes, you get a personal whatever, but then suddenly I had to make so many decisions with his parents to find out where will he be buried. Too many decisions for me to make in such a short time, and I just didn't want to do anything. But then Al's parents wanted me to be, you know, just to be a little more optimistic or something. I mean, everybody talked about how Jackie Kennedy was so strong when Jack Kennedy died. I said, I'm no Jackie Onassis. I mean, you know, I'm just, so if I have to cry, I have to cry, and I have to, you know, I just wanted to mourn, like my traditions in Bolivia. In Bolivia, we mourn. When somebody dies, then things stop. People don't work. We just stop and mourn and have visitations and things like that. But here, it's a different way. And I remember him all the time. When somebody dies, they don't go away. And every single one of those, of the people, you know, of the human beings that die in a war, there's a family that is also wounded.
While Emma was left to grieve, many other wives were left in a hellish limbo. Their husbands were prisoners of war, hundreds of men taken for months or years and tortured. That was new during the Vietnam War, and for a long time, Americans didn't really know it was happening. That was until an unlikely sorority of war wives stepped out of the shadows. Heath Lee is the author of The League of Wives, The Untold Story of the Women Who Took on the U.S. Government to Bring Their Husbands Home from Vietnam.
The way that the women learned about this was almost always the same. You would see a black sedan in your driveway, and this was an immediate sign that something was really badly wrong. And there was a protocol that was followed where you would have an officer and a chaplain generally come in the house, often accompanied by your best friend, say a colonel's wife or a sergeant major's wife that you knew, but it would always be those same three people, the black sedan, and then they would tell you what they thought had happened.
And at this time, most people, even politicians, didn't know what a POW was. But before long, hundreds of wives would be forced to learn, and they needed the rest of the country to learn too. Was Sybil Stockdale the first one to actually break silence? My husband is a POW and I am going public?
Yes. In 1968, she went to the San Diego Union Tribune and gave the first interview saying, "The North Vietnamese are torturing everyone. My husband's a prisoner. Do something about it."
So Sybil went to the paper and TV, and the media rallied to her call. Here she is speaking to Barbara Walters and Hugh Downs on the Today Show in January 1970.
"We are trying to make the world aware of the desperate plight of the prisoners. Possibly most important right now is to have a record of the concern of the American people. Just a postcard or a letter saying, 'I am concerned about the American prisoners of war.' It would probably be one of the most helpful things they can do." He will publicize
it. Jane Denton became another prominent activist for POWs. It was her husband in a video message released by his captors who famously blinked the letters of the word torture in Morse code. Jane and Sybil were very different but very effective advocates, but neither of them had been prepared for this.
Jane was very much a Southern belle, very Southern in her ways, hated conflict, was the last person on earth who wanted to be an activist. She wanted to be a wife and mother and a hostess, and she was really what you think of when you think of the perfect military wife. That was Jane. And she was also highly diplomatic. That turned out to be what set her apart from some of her other colleagues, is her diplomacy, her ability to mobilize people. She was one of the biggest advocates for POWs and MIAs and went to great lengths to work with different contingencies to bring her husband home.
Those different contingencies proved vital. Sybil and the other wives of POWs were talking to the media, to congressmen, to Henry Kissinger even, but they couldn't talk to the people they wanted to hear from the most. Their husbands.
One of the women told me, one of these POW wives said, "We would do a deal with the devil if we had to get information through to our men."
And they sort of did when they turned to an unlikely alliance.
So these are very traditional hat and glove military wives, very prim and proper.
Not the kinds of women who would typically associate with anti-war activists.
I think the POW wives, a lot of them did not get along with the women that I studied.
This is Jessica Frazier. She studies a group of women anti-war activists.
What got me to study this in the first place was just this idea that these women who were middle-aged, who had young children at home, were traveling to a war zone where there was active bombing sometimes. And why were they doing that?
They wanted to know what exactly their government was doing. And they wanted to stop the war.
In 1965, when Johnson first sent troops to South Vietnam and started the air war over North Vietnam, there were women in the organization Women Strike for Peace in particular who were concerned about what was going on in Vietnam. And the North Vietnamese invited them on to Hanoi at that time in order to meet with the Vietnamese Women's Union. The North Vietnamese government did not approve visas for reporters, and it fell to anti-war activists who could get their visas approved by the North Vietnamese government to travel to Hanoi to find out what was going on.
Once in Hanoi, the anti-war activists started building relationships with Vietnamese women who were also advocating for peace.
The Women's Strike for Peace women often used maternal language. They represented themselves as mothers who were simply concerned for their children. They were concerned that their children were going to be sent to Vietnam to fight and that they would die there. The Vietnamese women used similar language, saying that they were concerned about the Vietnam War as well because they were mothers of soldiers and their sons were going to die in this war, and so they wanted American women to help them stop the war.
The trust that the anti-war activists had built in North Vietnam gave them access to the prisoners of war that no one else had. They were able to set up a mail exchange, and the war wives back home were finally allowed to start writing to their captive husbands. Here's Heath Lee again.
And that's when the ladies that I've researched started coding letters to their husbands with secret messages. So that was quite dangerous, and the women were basically Jane Bonds, doing all kinds of spy work for the government. A lot of information was passed that way. That was one of the very successful ways they were able to also get an accounting for who was there, who was dead, who was missing in action.
After almost 8 years of captivity and torture, Jim Stockdale and Jerry Denton made it home.
Jerry Denton is the first one off the first plane. And he gives this amazing speech you can still find on YouTube saying, "We have been through a difficult time, but we're so happy we could serve our country.
Serve our country under difficult circumstances."
And at the end, he's almost crying and he says, "God bless America."
God bless America. God bless America.
It's one of the most moving things I've ever seen.
How did these women respond when their husbands came home? Were they happy or was it tough?
You know, I think they all responded differently based on their personality. Jane Denton always wanted to be a mother and a wife. And so it was a lot easier for her to go back to a more submissive role, a more role where her husband kind of ruled the roost a bit more. Sybil Stockdale, on the other hand, who had been the big leader of this whole POW MIA movement, was in contact with Kissinger and Nixon all the time and was really good at it. This was like a career she would have excelled as a diplomat or as a, you know, political leader. It was really hard for her. She had episodes of depression post-war because I think she didn't feel as useful anymore.
Heath Lee is the author of The League of Wives, the untold story of the women who took on the U.S. government to bring their husbands home from Vietnam. Figuring out how to act and who you are as the wife of a Vietnam soldier is something Marion Faye Novak can relate to. Marion's the author of Lonely Girls with Burning Eyes, a wife recalls her husband's journey home from Vietnam. Marion's husband, a Marine, left for Vietnam about a year after they were married. As anti-war sentiment grew, Marion, a new mother, felt very alone, and she struggled to glean anything she could from the letters of a quiet military man she didn't really know very well.
He'd asked me out in the fall, and I didn't really care for him. He was too quiet. One day, he caught me by surprise in a rainstorm, and I got a call that night, and he said, "You spoke to me today. Does that mean you'll go out with me again?" And I did. And in those days, the Marines had all white for their summer spring uniform. White hat, white gloves, white shoes, white socks, and those gold globe and anchors. And I saw him coming up the walk, and I opened the door, and there he was, standing against all that green. He was like a knight in shining armor. It wasn't long after that he proposed. We used to play bridge a lot at the student union, and people would gossip about their hometowns, and somebody mentioned that somebody had been killed in Vietnam. And I thought, wow, what's that, a war? I knew nothing. I knew nothing, except from friends of mine who were very active in the anti-war movement, and they were very interested in educating me, but it didn't make sense what they were saying, because Dave isn't stupid, and he's a good man, and he was going to go and fight. His argument was always, if I don't go, Marion, somebody will go in my place. They're not going to take one less. He said, "I'll do my part." My parents were living in Fresno at the time, and so we were visiting with them right before we had to leave, and something happened. We went into a quiet little bar, just the two of us there, and there was one man. And he told Dave, he said, "Good luck." Just like that, "Good luck." And he patted him on the shoulder, and he went over and paid for our drinks. And I knew that wasn't good.
that was probably not good. So when Dave left, he left from California, from Travis Air Force Base in May of 1967. And I can still see, right now, the men filing up the steel steps onto the plane. And I remember thinking, some of them won't come back. I hope it's the others, not my husband. My daughter Jeannie was born July 25th, 1967. When I called the Red Cross, I asked them, how long will it take my husband to find out that he's a father? She said it would be 17 hours. So from the moment I heard that, time became a very odd thing. I didn't know any moment whether my husband was dead or whether he was alive. I didn't know who I was. I didn't know if I was still a wife. I didn't know if I was a young widow. I didn't know who I was. Berkeley, of course, is exploding. It was a leader in this anti-war movement. I finally learned not to tell people that my husband was in Vietnam. I didn't want the kind of support that, you know, we think he's a great guy. We just hate what he is, you know? So I just stayed away from people. And one thing the military, the Marine Corps had done that I felt was not good, they did treat wives like the old saying that they used to throw around. If the Marines wanted you to have a wife, they would, you know, they'd issue you one. I wrote every day. Dave wrote much less often. My husband is not a talker, but I was still very, very frustrated because the letters hadn't been more detailed. You wouldn't have known they were war if you didn't see the red dirt on them. And I don't think he understood what was going on at home. He thought it was luxury. He thought I had movies to go to, I had air conditioning and a cold Coke. He didn't understand that none of that mattered, that I was in Vietnam in my head with him all the time, where he could rest once in a while because he knew he was safe. I had to worry every minute. Every minute I was awake, every minute. I remember asking him, did you kill anybody? And he said, I couldn't see for sure. I know the depth of it now. And when I read the letters over 20 years after he wrote them, I can read them now and see what he's not saying. I can feel what he's not telling me. I knew a woman who, of course, had the casualty officer come to the door. I know that it was a terrible, terrible thing, but she couldn't get past it either. She never remarried. Her heart was just broken, and, you know, she couldn't recoup enough to go on. I had another friend who had a visit from the casualty officer. She went on. She remarried. I told my husband once, he asked me something about what are we going to do, and later he told me the advice I gave him was the best I ever gave him, and that was this. I said, we're going to love the war. We're going to love it. It has made us who we are. We met some of the best people in our lives. We know what we can and cannot do. We know what we can and cannot stand. A lot of people never find out, but we did. And I said, we're going to love it. And that satisfied him. I don't know if it satisfies me, but I believe it. And I'm grateful. I'm grateful that he lived. I'm grateful that he did what he thought he had to do. And I'm grateful that I'm still here.
That was Marion Faye Novak, author of Lonely Girls with Burning Eyes. A wife recalls her husband's journey home from Vietnam. This program was made possible in part by a major grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities, Exploring the Human Endeavor. Support for With Good Reason is provided by the University of Virginia Health System, pioneering treatments to save lives and preserve brain function for stroke patients. UVAHealth.com. With Good Reason is produced by Virginia Humanities, which acknowledges the Monacan Nation, the original people of the land and waters of our home in Charlottesville, Virginia. Our production team is Allison Quantz, Matt Darrow, Lauren Francis, and Jamal Milner. Allison Byrne worked on this episode. Cassandra Deering and Aviva Casto are our interns. Special thanks this week to Jenny Taylor. For the podcast, go to withgoodreasonradio.org. I'm Sarah McConnell. Thanks for listening.
saw that thing so beautiful.
Dada!
She just hit my heart, oh.
Dada!
Full force, and she got me like.
Dada!
I be like.
Dada!
Baby,
Dada!
Why you so fine?
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 9:59 a.m. Next up is American Standoff with Jacqueline Keeler.
Hold your head up, lift the top.